Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are getting into something absolutely central, I think, to the future of the learning experience, and that's student well-being.
Yeah, it really is critical.
We all know the challenge is, well, it's huge. Mental health concerns among college students are definitely climbing. And there's this statistic, something like 81% of students with significant symptoms face at least one barrier getting care.
That's right. Things like limited access, maybe just not having enough time, or, you know, that stigma that still hangs around seeking help.
Exactly. And the traditional clinical counseling services, they're vital, of course.
Right.
But they're clearly not enough on their own to meet this growing demand.
They just can't scale in the same way, and they don't reach everyone. So we have to look at, well, new design solutions, right? New approaches. And that's really what we're diving into today.
Right. So our mission here is to unpack a really promising, potentially scalable idea. Professional peer support. We're digging into the findings from a pilot study by WGU and Flourish Labs, looking at their peers.net platform.
And this isn't just like your buddy system. This model pairs students with trained professional supporters who actually share similar lived experiences. That's the key difference.
That shared experience piece seems crucial, especially for higher ed leaders listening, right?
Yeah.
Because of who this model seems to reach most effectively.
Yeah, the research backs this up. Young adults, students from historically marginalized groups, they often prefer support from someone who kind of gets their background. There can be a lack of trust sometimes with traditional professionals who might not share that context.
Mm-hmm. So peer support potentially offers that bridge.
It really does. It builds trust differently.
Okay, so tell us about the pilot itself. What was the scope?
It was pretty significant. They reached out to over 84,000 eligible WGU students, specifically focusing on the 18 to 30 age group for this peers.net service.
84,000, wow.
Yeah, and then the researchers followed up, you know, with surveys, in-depth interviews with the students who actually used it to see how it really worked in a big online university setting like WGU.
Okay, so let's get into what they found. And I think we should start with something that jumped out at me, the utilization data. It was kind of surprising.
It really was. And I think what's fascinating, what this data shows, is how quickly this kind of service tapped into a demand that maybe wasn't being met, a latent demand.
Latent demand, right.
It's sort of the proof point, I think, for why people in ed tech, people thinking about institutional strategy, really need to look closely at this kind of middle tier of support.
I agree. So let's break down those numbers. Out of the, 84,000 plus students contacted, 132 actually used the service at least once.
Okay.
Which, okay, translates to a 0.16% usage rate during that pilot window. Now, here's the kicker. Compare that to the 0.11% of the entire student body who used WGU's traditional counseling services in that same period.
Wow. Okay, so let that sink in. This brand new service, still in a pilot phase, probably limited outreach.
Yeah, soft launch, basically.
Right. It still had a higher utilization rate than the established, you know, professional clinical counseling that was already available. That definitely gets your attention.
It does. But let's, you know, play devil's advocate for a second.
Mm-hmm.
0.16%. That raw number is still pretty small in the grand scheme of 84,000.
It's true.
So is this model genuinely expanding the total number of students getting support? Or are institutions maybe just shifting a small group from one service to another?
That's a fair question. But the study suggests it really is reaching new people, or at least engaging them differently. And that's where you look beyond just the first use. You look at the engagement data.
Okay.
This wasn't just students kicking the tires, so to speak. 80%, 80, of the students they interviewed were either meeting their peer supporter regularly, or they said they fully intended to start meeting regularly.
80%. That's sticky.
Very sticky. And get this. 11% were what they called super users. That means 11 or more sessions.
11 plus sessions, wow.
Yeah, so that sustained interaction, that tells you something. It shows there's this real latent demand for a support option that feels comfortable, that students can actually integrate into their routine. It sits, like you said, perfectly between, you know, DIY resources and formal therapy.
That sustained engagement really speaks to the value proposition then. It must be hitting the mark for those users. Which brings us to, I think, why academic leaders really need to tune into this. The positive outcomes reported weren't just, you know, I feel a bit better. they seem foundational to student success, to persistence.
Exactly. The feedback was, overwhelmingly positive. Over 85% of the students surveyed agreed the peer support was beneficial, and not just beneficial, but added concrete value to their WGU experience.
Added value to the WTU experience. That's institutional benefit right there.
Totally. Students weren't just feeling better emotionally. They felt they were gaining actual skills, skills that directly help with focus, with managing your studies.
Okay, tell us more about that scope, because when we, people designing learning experiences, we often think curriculum, tech platforms.
Yeah.
But this data suggests well-being support is deeply integrated into those core success metrics.
Oh, absolutely. The support covered a huge range. Yes, students looked for, basic social support, empathy, someone to talk to. That's expected.
Sure.
But they also used the sessions to learn really practical mental well-being techniques, things like self-regulation, how to set boundaries, skills that are just crucial if you're juggling online learning, work, life.
The boundary setting. Yeah, that's huge for online learners.
Huge. And maybe more surprising for some, they used it for accountability around physical well-being, like meal planning.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe most directly relevant to retention, they used it for improving academic performance. Things like goal setting, getting study tips from their peer.
Okay, so let's connect the dots there.
Yeah.
If a student uses peer support, maybe they learn to set better boundaries.
Yeah.
That probably means they handle their workload better, maybe feel less overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Which could directly translate to them being less likely to burn out and drop out, right?
Precisely.
Yeah.
It's not just a nice to have. It functions as a foundational success tool integrated into their coping strategies.
That's powerful.
And look at student preference. This was fascinating. They were 14 percentage points more willing to seek out peer support in the future compared to traditional mental health support.
14 points higher preference for peer support. Why? What drove that?
Well, according to the students, the key things were: number one, non-judgmental, active listening. Number two, that powerful factor of a shared background.
Ah, the relatability again.
Yeah, it created this sense of perceived reciprocity. The feeling was very much, this person gets it. They understand because they've kind of been through something similar.
Okay, this person gets it. That feels like the core value prop. But here's where, the institutional strategy side gets really interesting and maybe tricky.
Mm.
Because it seems like the success really hinges on getting the execution and the integration just right. While the outcomes were good, the study also flagged some significant limitations, particularly around fit.
Context is everything. You nailed it. Especially for a huge, diverse, non-traditional institution like WGU, students were pretty explicit in the interviews. They wished their peer supporters understood the unique challenges of online college better.
Okay.
And ideally, they preferred them to be actual WGU students, current ones, or maybe alumni, someone who knew the system.
And then there's that demographic friction issue, wasn't there, with the age limit?
Yeah, that was a big one. The peers.net platform had an age cutoff, 13 to 30. Now, at WGU, the median student age is 33.
33. So most students.
So 68%. More than two-thirds of the entire WGU population was actually ineligible purely based on age.
Wow. Okay.
And students noticed that. They mentioned the lack of older peer supporters, the lack of diversity reflecting the actual student body.
And that breaks the magic, doesn't it? That feeling of this person gets it.
It completely undermines that psychological safety, that relatability we just talked about. We heard anecdotes, students saying things like they felt stalked in my tracks when they tried to talk about specific WGU things.
Like what?
Like, say, competency-based assessments or navigating the WGU portal, and the peer supporter just had no clue, no context for the school itself. Mm. So the supporter might have been relatable in age, maybe, for that younger segment, but totally unrelatable in terms of the actual institutional experience.
That feels like a massive takeaway for any leader thinking about implementing this. Credibility is totally tied to that institutional relatability.
Absolutely.
So if you're trying to scale peer support, particularly for, say, online learners, adult learners,
yeah,
you have to figure out how to recruit supporters from within that specific community.
Yes. It shifts the challenge, doesn't it? It's not just about finding a peer. It's finding a contextual peer, someone who understands the specific environment. The strategic implication is pretty stark, I think. Context-specific, community-specific support is really necessary for this to work well, especially for institutions with diverse or, niche student populations.
Mm.
Off-the-shelf, generic peer support models, they're probably always going to hit this wall.
Okay. So fit and context are paramount.
Yeah.
Now let's pivot slightly and talk about boundaries and safety, because that's got to be top of mind for institutional leaders too.
Essential.
Peer support sounds powerful, a great complement maybe, but we need to be super clear about its scope.
Absolutely. Let's state it clearly. Peer support is not a replacement for clinical counseling. It's just not sufficient for students with severe clinical needs. Period.
Okay.
But its greatest strength, maybe, is acting as that effective bridge. We saw this in the study. Students who'd never had counseling before found peer support way less intimidating.
Easier first step.
Much easier. It helped them get over that social stigma they actually talked about. One student put it like, as soon as you get therapy, something's automatically wrong. Peer support didn't feel like that.
Wow, that quote, something's automatically wrong. That really captures the barrier, doesn't it? So peer support helps normalize seeking help, makes it feel less clinical.
Exactly. It's an entry point and normalizes well-being support as just part of the student experience. But, and this is important, the system also showed its limits. Some students did feel their peer supporter was, quote, ill-equipped when they brought up deeper personal issues.
Right. And that's the boundary line.
That immediately flags the need for, well, several things. Rigorous professional training for the peers, absolutely. Clear guidelines on scope and boundaries, and critically, really robust referral system.
Referral systems. Okay. Yeah. And you mentioned earlier, leaders need clear pathways. You use the term warm handoff protocols.
Yes. Let's unpack that because it's important.
Please do. Uh-huh. What does a warm handoff actually look like compared to just, you know, giving someone a phone number?
Yeah. Okay. So a cold referral is basically just that. Giving a distressed student a website, a phone number, maybe an email for the counseling center. And then it's entirely on the student to take that next, often really difficult step alone.
Right. Lots of friction there.
Tons. A warm handoff, on the other hand, is a much more managed transition. The peer supporter, following clear protocols, actually helps facilitate the introduction to the licensed professional.
Ow.
It could mean, maybe, staying on the line while the student makes the first call, mm-hmm. or helping schedule that first appointment, or even just making a direct introduction via secure message with the student's consent, of course. The point is, it smooths the path.
Okay. It reduces that friction and anxiety around seeking clinical care and hopefully ensures students who really do need that higher level of care don't fall through the cracks between the two services.
Exactly. It's about creating a supportive ecosystem, not just siloed services.
Ecosystem. Okay. And speaking of friction, this brings us to the nuts and bolts, the operational details. This is where, you know, institutional budgets and maybe ed tech choices really intersect.
Right.
Let's talk usability. Key takeaway 5, right? Technical friction can kill a great idea.
Oh, it absolutely can. And it almost did here, to some extent. Students reported having real difficulty logging into the HIPAA compliant platform that peers.net used for messaging.
Difficulty how? Like passwords? Interface?
It sounds like it was just clunky.
Yeah.
Not intuitive. And the result was, because the official platform was hard to use, students started just using regular unsecured email to talk to their peer supporters.
Oof. Okay, that's not good.
Not good at all. Increases risk, reduces engagement because it's not integrated. It really highlights that fundamental trade-off, doesn't it?
Yeah. Institutions have to prioritize HIPAA, security, privacy. But if making it compliant makes it unusable,
then students will find workarounds, often unsafe ones. So for the edtech providers listening, the message is clear. The platform has to be secure, yes, but it also has to be seamlessly accessible.
Like single sign-on, maybe? Good integration with other university systems? Mobile-first design.
All of the above. Anything that reduces login friction. Poor user experience, poor UX. It's not just annoying. It directly kills utilization. It has to be easy.
Okay. Easy and secure. Got it. Now, staying on the operational side, what about the things that did work well operationally? What fostered that loyalty and trust we talked about? Lesson 2, I think.
Yes. Something students really, really appreciated was the fact that the sessions were unlimited and free.
Unlimited and free. That's a big deal compared to a lot of traditional EAPs or counseling limits.
Huge. Students explicitly said they sometimes avoided traditional resources because they worried about session caps. You know, the fear of building rapport with someone, starting to make progress, and then boom, you're out of sessions and maybe can't afford to continue on your own.
Yeah, that would definitely stop you from wanting to start.
Right. So that consistency, knowing the support was there reliably, without a ticking clock or a surprise bill, yeah, that made students feel like the institution was genuinely invested in them. One student said it showed WGU practices what they preach about student support.
Practices what they preach. That's powerful feedback for an institution. Mm. So Offering unlimited sessions, if you can swing it budget-wise, isn't just a nice hook, it's actually a strategy.
It's a trust-building strategy. It encourages that sustained engagement we saw, which is likely where the real behavior change and benefit happens.
Okay, sense. So any relatability, clear boundaries, warm handoff, seamless tech, and maybe unlimited sessions. Right. What else? What about just knowing the service exists?
Yes, awareness.
Yeah.
Lesson four. And this one was honestly kind of shocking.
Okay.
Despite WGU having traditional counseling services available, an incredible 89% of the students surveyed for this pilot study were unaware that the university even offered traditional counseling.
89% were unaware. That's staggering.
It really is a massive disconnect between providing a service and actually communicating its existence effectively.
So you can build the best services in the world, but if nobody knows about them,
they might as well not exist from a utilization standpoint. So the lesson here is that peer support or any support service has to be embedded within a really clearly communicated, easy to navigate student wellness ecosystem.
Ecosystem again.
Sure.
Not just a list of links on a web page somewhere.
Exactly. Students need to understand what's available, who it's for, how it relates to other services like, you know, academic advising or disability services. If they can't find it easily or if they don't understand how peer support fits in, usage will lag. Institutions need to, like, design a clear system map for students.
A map of support. I like that. Okay, so let's try and synthesize all this, particularly for our listeners who are focused on designing that future learning experience, thinking about retention. What are the big headlines?
Well, first, professional peer support clearly drives up utilization. It taps into that latent demand we talked about.
Right. Reaches students who might not use other things.
Second, it delivers really strong, positive outcomes, not just for general well-being, but for things that directly impact academic goals, too. And it seems to act as a powerful antidote to that stigma around seeking help.
Okay, so high utilization potential, positive outcomes, reduces stigma. Sounds great, but...
But the critical lessons are all about the execution. It's operational and strategic. Success absolutely depends on it being deeply institutionally integrated. It must be demographically aligned with the students you're trying to reach.
Which means recruiting those context-specific supporters.
Yeah.
People who know the institution.
Yes. And it has to be technologically seamless. You've got to conquer that usability friction that often plagues secure platforms.
Got it. Integration, alignment, seamless tech. And ultimately, it seems like this kind of service, when done right, it does more than just help with mental health symptoms. It really seems to boost the student's sense of belonging.
Absolutely. And that generates positive feelings towards the institution itself, which, as we know, is vital for persistence and retention.
Right. Okay, so let's wrap this up. As we close out this deep dive, you mentioned persistence. Let's connect well-being directly back to that bottom line. Academic success and retention. That's the ultimate goal for every higher ed leader, right?
It really is. And the link is clear. There was a study back in 2019 that looked at students with low GPAs. It found that 25%, a quarter, of those who showed signs of mental health challenges dropped out of college.
A quarter, okay.
Compare that to only 10% of students with low GPAs without those mental health symptoms. The difference is stark. Addressing mental health isn't just a side issue, it is a core retention strategy.
It's fundamental. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's leave our listeners with a provocative thought then, something to chew on as they design the learning experience of the future at their own institutions.
Right.
Here it is. If we accept that professional peer support, when it's properly aligned, properly integrated, really can enhance a student's sense of belonging in their academic focus, and if it could potentially do that more scalably for the general student population's needs than, say, expanding expensive clinical counseling, then the question is, how much institutional resource, how much focus should maybe be shifted? Shifted away from maybe solely traditional retention efforts or purely clinical expansions towards funding and perfecting these scalable, seamless, peer-led well-being interventions that seem to get right at the underlying barriers preventing student success.
That's the question to wrestle with. Where does this fit in the overall strategy and budget?
Definitely something to think about.
Until next time, keep digging.